Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Monday, January the 10th, as we like to do once a week, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. 10 days into 2022, and President Biden is still at 40%. So we'll talk a little bit about that. New York City in the news quite a bit. Lots of stories out of New York City. We'll be catching up with that. The media. I've got several questions about the media that I want to bring up today. And then, of course, the vice president and January the 6th, the jobs report, Justice Sotomayor. Lots of stuff to get into today. The CDC, very confusing comments coming out of the director's interview with Fox News yesterday. So lots to get into. Let me say hello to our good friend. Happy New Year again, Bill.
Oh, and thank you, and to you, Silvio, and to your family.
Thank you. It's, I said it's now, 10 days
of course
into
we
20...
have to...
Go ahead. I was going to say it's 10 days into 2022,
just...
and it seems like... The...
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say 10 days into 2022, and the topics don't change, Bill.
No, they don't. They don't change from now, day by day. They don't change, apparently, decade by decade, because now we're having the... esteemed and a very scholarly vice president of the United States comparing her treatment to the treatment of all other vice presidents of the United States, most of whom she's probably never heard of. You know, I mean, and she's saying now that there's now a big pushback on the part of Kamala Harris's defenders and supporters to claim that she's only being criticized because she is a woman of color. And right. That if she were a male like all the others, this would not have happened. She apparently has never heard of Richard Nixon. He was
Dan
hit
Quayle.
Every day. I mean, or Dan Quayle, who was called an
yes.
idiot and a moron, or Henry Wallace, who was actually removed from the Democratic ticket in 1944. She apparently thinks they all had it very good. Now,
right,
you don't
right.
expect much from Kamala. You don't expect much from Kamala Harris because she really, in her mind, thinks she's vice president of a student government. I mean, I think that's the problem in a junior high school.
Well, of course, she began. I think she started all of this. I mean, she's getting. You know, there's always politics. I'll cut her some slack on that. There's always politics, but there's always, like you said, Dan Quayle. I don't remember anybody being treated any worse than Dan Quayle. But and you mentioned Richard Nixon, whenever that was, and. So, I mean, the vice president is always going to get some politics, but it doesn't help when the vice president is given an assignment to do something about the border, Bill, and then the Democrat representative on the border, Henry Cuellar, said he hasn't heard from the vice president about the border. It doesn't help when she gives a speech on the January the 6th saying that, you know, there are certain dates in American history like 9/11 and December 7th. And I guess January 6th is in that class. I mean, look, I don't think you have to be political to realize how stupid that is, Bill.
Oh, it's completely ignorant. First of all, I wish one of the reporters present had the courage to reply to her and say, Madam Vice President, could you tell us what happened on December 7th, 1941? And I really wonder if she knows. I mean, the speech was probably written for her. But I really wonder what she knows. I mean, I don't know what the problem there is. I don't think she's inherently stupid. She's never been called stupid in her career. But she just does not seem to be able to grasp the office that she holds and her responsibilities. and it's getting very, very serious. You know, the jokes are coming. People say, well, Joe Biden's insurance policy for staying in office and not being thrown out is Kamala Harris. Because people say he ought to be thrown out. People say we then have Kamala Harris. Oh, yeah, I forgot that. Yeah, I mean, her approval ratings are like 28%, 29%. I mean, I think you'd have a higher approval rating in the United States for bedbugs.
Right.
And what it is, it's not just disapproval. She's disliked. And I think that may be a little unfair. But she is disliked. And nothing is being done about it. I think, you know, if she had the ability to put a good staff together, to deliver an important speech on foreign policy, but she hasn't. And apparently now also the issue that is being brought up, and it's one that does resonate with people, is that she treats her staff very badly. And people are annoyed by that. They want to hear that their high public officials treat their staffs well and are, you know, and are a pleasure to deal with. But this is not the first time this has come up at that level. Hillary Clinton is also known or was known when she was first lady for treating her staff very badly. Some people, on the other hand, were known for treating the staff very well. I mean, Mrs. Bush, Bush 43's wife was really a gem to deal with, apparently. Others have been very, very respectful of their staffs, but apparently not Kamala Harris. And that can come back to really hurt you because people talk to the press.
Yeah. Well, my feeling is that there's always politics. So, you know, there's always going to give, you know, you're always going to have politics mixing into anything. But I think in this case, at least from my perspective, is that this lady was given a very important task to do something about the border, to at least to oversee what was happening on the border. And she hasn't taken it seriously. And now she gives a speech like she gave the other day, which is frankly an insult to the people in New York City, where you are, Bill, who were killed that day, those firemen and those police officers who literally went into that building. I mean, that is such an insult to those people. But here's a question I have, Bill. And let me ask you this, because how in the world does a draft like that, mentioning that or comparing January 6th to September 11th, how does a draft like that get by the speechwriters? I mean, I would have thought that at one time that there would have been speechwriters who said, you know, that's not a good idea to make that comparison between January the 6th. I mean, you can say that you were impacted by January the 6th. Okay, that's fair. But to draw the comparison, Bill, I think at one time there would have been somebody in the White House who would have said, no, you can't say that. Madam Vice President, you cannot say that. And so what does that tell you? I guess that's my question, Bill. What does that tell you about the staff in this White House? Are these a bunch of left-wingers who believe stuff like that, or are they just not very serious people, Bill?
I think it's probably a combination. I think that one of the things that Washington journalism never seems to learn is that when they are announcing the appointments in a new administration, they give all the attention to the cabinet-level appointments. They don't give enough attention to the people who are at the mid-level, like assistant secretaries, people who are at the mid-level in the White House. They often are the ones who make day-to-day policy, and they often have a great deal of influence. And this administration seems particularly mediocre. I think it's even possible that some of these mid-level groups in different government agencies are actually running the agencies, but the press has no interest in reporting it. They have no interest in discussing it. I mean, I think we're involved today, for example, in the Iran negotiations, and I am very concerned as a citizen about the influence of these negotiations that is being exerted by mid-level assistant secretaries in the State Department. Mm-hmm. They have great access to high-ranking officials. Some of them are clearly people from the Obama administration, the head negotiator on Iran for Biden. It's the same head negotiator from Barack Obama when we negotiated and got ourselves into that terrible nuclear deal. And I think that the point you raise is a very good one. People in the press are just not asking enough questions about the people at the mid-level who have influence every day.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not very familiar with every speechwriter, but I remember Peggy Noonan, Tony Snow, who wrote for, I guess, the first President Bush, Mark Thiessen, who wrote for the second President Bush. But it seems to me that those were pretty serious people who would have picked up on this and said,
yes,
you cannot say that. You cannot say that. That is simply over the line. And she got away with it. Nobody's asking her any questions. She was on PBS, I guess, a few days ago. And she didn't get a question about that, about the comparison that she made. So, I mean, the media is either not engaged or they're part of the problem. I want to bring up the media again because this weekend, Speaker Pelosi was on Face the Nation. Now, I don't usually watch that show, but I did read the transcript. And Speaker Pelosi basically said the Republicans who broke into the Capitol. And the host of the program didn't say, isn't that unfair on Republicans? I mean, 725 people broke into the Capitol or were charged or whatever. There's a lot more Republicans. I mean, it's a very small percentage of Republicans, certainly even the ones who were there that day, Bill. But it's like she gets away with saying stuff like that. And that's what's frustrating, Bill.
Well, the modern press in America is a left-wing press. Its beliefs start from the left, and they believe that that's a good guidepost. They really have no interest in truly objective, thoughtful, and complete journalism. They have an interest in improving society, and they think they're really going to do it by the kind of reporting they do. So they give a pass to anybody with the right point of view. Well, that is not journalism. That's propaganda, and that's what we're getting right now. I'm very concerned about the effects of the press on every news story and on every subject. And I also believe that political observers are underestimating press corruption as a feature in the 2022 midterms. Now, I'm not pointing my finger at any one person, but clearly there are newspapers like the New York Times that where they've got their finger on the scale and stories are reported to produce a point of view. It's very hard to deal with this subject because to get a discussion going, you have to depend on journalists to have the discussion. And they clearly are part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Over at Powerline, they have a story that came out Sunday pointing out that the television ratings for January the 6th were a disaster for CNN and MSNBC. Fox News came in, they had the president's speech, the vice president's speech, and then they took off to their regular programming. But CNN and MSNBC, you would have thought that this was the most important date in American history, but the American people responded by not watching it. So maybe that's the way the people
yes.
get back at them, by not watching it. But it's a very interesting story over in Powerline about this. But the vice president, and you mentioned this before we went on the air, is also having or accusing the Spanish media of some kind of a campaign against her. And that's very surprising to me because, frankly, Univision and especially Univision has always been very kind to the Democrats. Not everyone, but, I mean, historically they've been. And I think the real fight that the vice president is having is with the Miami media, which tends to be more Cuban and more conservative. But the interesting thing is that the media in Miami is fighting back. They're giving it right back to her and saying, no, we're just challenging you, something you're not accustomed to, Madam Vice President.
I think that's true. And I think that one of the trends in American politics that we've been talking about in the last year has been the willingness of Hispanic voters to move away from the Democratic Party, which had been a home for a long time, and to consider the Republican Party. We saw that dramatically in the Virginia governorship race, where the Republican candidate actually carried the Hispanic vote. And very little attention was given to it in the press. I mean, I think they were just mortified. But that is really an earthquake in politics. We're also seeing it in other communities. We're seeing young black men showing more interest in the Republican Party. We're seeing more Asians showing more interest in the Republican Party. And I think that the Democratic Party is in serious trouble if it thinks it has these groups in the palm of its hand. I think that may have been true at one time, but it certainly isn't true today.
No, it's not. It's not at all. And you know, the fellow who wrote the famous book about the emerging Democrat majority, a fellow by the name of Teixeira, he's walking it back right now, saying they have a real problem with Democrats. But let's talk about January the 6th, because I don't know. It's interesting to me how this happened. On the 6th of January, the White House went crazy with January the 6th, but it's almost as if reality hit them between the eyes, because the very next day, of course, came out the jobs report, and that was a disaster. I mean, I know that the unemployment rate is 3.9, and that's a good number historically, but I have my doubts about that number, Bill, and they come from my reaction to that number is it's a good number, but if 4 million people have left the workforce, how do we even know who's employed and who's not unemployed? I mean, these people who
That's
are
right.
leaving the workforce, what are they doing? I don't think they all won the lottery or something, so they have to be either retired or they're doing something else to support themselves. And I'm beginning to wonder if maybe many of these people, if there's like an underground economy being created in the country where a lot of people are just, you know, they're not paying taxes, they're off the books, but they're still surviving, Bill.
Yes. Well, some of them, of course, are surviving on very generous government benefits. And that, of course, is something that thoughtful people in government have been discussing and think that should be ended in many cases. In many situations, people will say, well, I get more money from benefits than from working, so why should I not keep getting benefits? And the fact is that, you know, you keep feeding people more and more government benefits, they're less and less interested in working, because in many cases, these people came from jobs they didn't particularly like in the first place. I think that's one factor that has to be taken into consideration. Also, I think there's an alienation from society. You sense it everywhere. People, morale in America is very low. It's down to Jimmy Carter levels. And I think that many people feel, well, you know, if I don't work, I don't have to get involved in those people I knew before, whether it was office politics and competition and pressure. So why should I work? And I do think that idea is growing.
Yes. Well, there was a lady on Dallas television last night talking about this, basically saying that people are just kind of saying, I didn't like that place I used to work at. I didn't like the boss or whatever, so I'm just going to, you know, I'm not going to work there anymore, or I'll work from home. But at some point, Bill, people have to feed themselves and they have to pay the rent. And yes, there are some generous benefits, but those benefits are ending. So at some point, I keep asking myself, what are those people doing? See, I don't know anybody like that, okay? I have to confess. None of my friends have resigned, or some are retired, but that's a different situation. But none of them have walked away from their jobs. And I keep asking myself, what are these people doing to pay the rent, to pay the mortgage, to pay the bills? Because just because you walk away from your job, that doesn't mean your responsibilities walk away too, Bill.
That's true. Well, you know, one of the things we might want to ask about, how many people are borrowing a certain amount of money to stay away from their jobs, and how many people are devoted or have made the decision to use up part of their savings to stay away from the jobs? They just kind of like the lifestyle. And also, how many people are staying away from their jobs because they fear they will get COVID-19? I think all those questions need to be asked.
They are very legitimate questions. I also ask myself, I mean, there was a story that came out in the Dallas Morning News on Sunday afternoon, very detailed story about the Dallas economy, or the Texas economy, showing the number of people who are moving here. The numbers are unbelievable, and the number of jobs that are being created. So I think when you look at these national statistics, it's almost like you have to divide the country into red and blue, because we really have two economies. We have a red economy, which it seems to be prospering, and people are moving into these red states like Florida, Texas, and some of the others, and they're leaving the blue states. And I keep asking myself, you know, these states where people are moving out, how are they going to pay their taxes? I mean, eventually that's going to show up, Bill.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think that what we're basically both saying is we need a lot more statistical research on this subject, because the statistical research is probably based on understandings from the pre-pandemic era. And this is a very new ball game in American life. We haven't had a pandemic since 1918. And so people may be reacting in ways that nobody expected.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So when I hear 3.9% unemployment, that's a great number. I mean, that's a great number. I'm happy for the people who are working. But on the other hand, is it a true number? When you keep hearing about these people walking out, we were supposed to have 400,000 jobs. We got 190. I mean, that's a big mistake, Bill. I mean, if I don't know of too many. I mean, if you're in a private corporation and you tell your company, my business, I mean, I'm expecting $500,000 in sales this month, but only 190 comes in, you're probably going to lose your job, Bill, for making such a bad calculation. So who's calculating these things, and what are they basing it on, Bill?
I don't know. A lot of the information we get comes from the Department of Labor, and presumably they are reasonably well regarded in the research they do. But I agree that the situation today is so unusual that it may require entirely new mathematical methods to find out exactly what's going on in the country.
Yeah. I'm not saying, Bill, that I agree with you. I think these are capable people who are doing their best to, I mean, these are basically bureaucrats who do this work, and they're probably doing the best they can. But we need to look at these numbers and how we're calculating them, because in my mind, it doesn't make any sense. If we had 3.9% unemployment, this economy would be booming in ways that it was, Bill, 2 years ago. Or 2.5 years ago,
yes.
Or back in 2019. And I don't get that sense of confidence when I talk to people, Bill.
No. What is amazing is that you would think people would be running around saying, my God, the economy is booming. Let's go out and spend a lot of money. And some people are spending a lot of money. But the economy is perceived as being either weak or in a place that we don't understand. I mean, you go into big stores today, you don't find them jammed. You really don't. And there are many stores that are either going out of business or are cutting numbers of stores if it's a chain. You don't get the sense, the emotional sense of a business boom. And I think it's absolutely correct. There is just too much apprehension.
Well, I think that's what inflation does, by the way. That's what inflation does. Inflation has a way of making everybody feel a little weird, I guess, or strange, because you may have money in your pocket, but when you go to the store, it buys less. So you don't feel good.
Oh,
I think that's what inflation does.
Yes.
And I think the inflation is killing.
Yes, absolutely. And not only does inflation kill by the raising of prices, but one of the things I've noticed is that there seem to be, in many of the basic stores, the drug stores and the supermarkets, fewer and fewer things on sale. I go to those places all the time, and I've just noticed, it may be my imagination, but I don't think it is, that fewer and fewer items seem to be on sale. And that may simply be a reflection of the fact that the dealers, the stores, or the manufacturers cannot give those discounts as they used to give them. We have a note that we received right here in our building where I live. Downstairs there is an Italian restaurant, a very good one, and they have consistently been giving discount certificates to anybody who lived in the building, because they're part of the building. And they sent a note last week saying we can no longer do this because business just isn't that good. And I think that is much more typical of what is going on in the real world than we're being told.
That's right. That's right. And we're going to take a little break, but I just want to add something to what you just said. One of the things that I've noticed in the area when you go to particularly restaurants is that they now have signs on the door apologizing or basically saying, I'm sorry, but we've had to raise our prices, or I'm sorry, we don't have all the stuff we used to have before. So a lot of stores are telling their customers right on the door that, you know, we're out of this, we didn't get this, and I'm sorry that we had to increase prices, but that's just the way it is. So, you know, when you may have a lot of pocket in your hand when you walk into a restaurant like that, but when you see a sign like that, it makes you uncomfortable, Bill. And that's what I think is happening in the country, that the economy may be statistically good, but people don't feel it. That's what I think is happening, Bill.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, in the country. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk to our friend Bill. We got to talk about Iran. We got to talk about the unions and a few other things. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Just a reminder that the music that you hear in our podcast is the music of my good friend Carlos Geddes. And I have a link on the show information to his website if you want to pick up a copy of his very good CD. Carlos is a very talented musician from Venezuela. Let's get back to our friend Bill Katz. Bill, lots of things to get into in this second segment, but I want to begin with New York City, where you are, or at least the area. Because there was a terrible fire yesterday, and I don't know if you have any further information on that. Horrible. And then you have a new mayor who's been there for about 10 days, and I'm not sure how he's doing. Maybe it's too early. But the young woman who you refer to as Evita apparently got COVID when she went down to Florida, which is, I hope she recovers and does well, but she's catching a lot of flack for that, Bill.
Well, yes, she did announce that she has been diagnosed with COVID-19, and I think we'll see next that she'll say it's in retaliation for her not accepting dates from Republican senators or something something like that.
We
now know enough to realize that being vaccinated is not a guarantee that you won't get the virus, but it does seem to be true that if you are vaccinated, the effects of the virus will be dramatically reduced, you know, really to the level sometimes of a common cold. So getting vaccinated, you know, does have a very positive effect. Yes, she was ridiculed because she went down to Florida, a state whose governor she apparently despises, and had a heck of a time down there. That wasn't wearing her mask, and now she's come back and she's contracted COVID-19. I don't know what she does. She'll set herself up now as a martyr. You know, somebody, I have sacrificed my own skin for you, my fellow peasants, or whatever the way she talks. But yeah, we're learning.
No, but I was
going
to say, Bill,
I think,
if I may, just a quick thing I wanted to say, Bill, about AOC before we move on to the other topic of New York. I think what she's going to say, Bill, is this is what happens when you don't remove the filibuster, that she gets COVID.
That's right. <Yes. laughs> That's right. That's
she'll
right.
blame it on the filibuster, but anyway.
She'll blame it on the filibuster, or she'll claim that it was planted by Ron DeSantis. Or climate change, absolutely. And I think that, you know, people outside New York don't realize that she poses a threat to Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader. You notice that Schumer has been sounding more and more left-wing recently. He himself is a respected figure, but there is no great wanting of Schumer, and the fear is that she will primary him in the Democratic Party primary for the U.S. Senate this year. Now, I am sure they've done internal pollings on it, and I cannot believe that she would defeat Chuck Schumer in a party primary, but maybe Chuck Schumer is concerned about that.
Well, she can get a turnout probably, and that's a couple of other Democrat congressmen have gone down in these primaries here recently. So, I mean, it could happen, I suppose. But the mayor, you have a new mayor now for a couple of, or 10 days. You had a terrible fire.
Yes.
Anything else on that fire, Bill? I know it's a developing story, but I hear that it could have been, I guess, a malfunctioning heater or something like that, Bill?
Yes, apparently it started in a malfunctioning heater. That is the belief up to now. And there is no public suspicion of any nefarious act, except perhaps an act of negligence. It's a terrible thing because 19 people have been killed. Apparently 9, according to the most recent reports, were children. You had families wiped out. And it's one of a number of major fires we've had recently in New York. As far as the new mayor is concerned, Eric Adams, it's really too soon to say what he's going to do. One thing is clear. Anybody who expected a conservative is disappointed, and anyone who expected a complete change from the de Blasio years is disappointed. He is fundamentally a Democrat, a liberal Democrat. He has tremendous pressure on him from within the Democratic Party, from the red left. I mean, this is New York, after all. I mean, this is Moscow on the Hudson. And the city council is filled with real hard leftists. The party is filled with real hard leftists. And he is trying to negotiate a way where he can govern and run as a moderate Democrat. He has ambitions that go beyond New York. New York City. That's pretty obvious. And beyond New York City, the degree of Communist Party members in Nebraska is not high. And even in New York State, should you want to run for governor, upstate is very different from New York City. It's like two entirely different states. I mean, upstate is pretty conservative. So if he has ambitions that go beyond the city, and I think he does, he is walking a tightrope. And that tightrope can hurt him because the Democratic Party is at war with itself right now. We have a governor who was Andy Cuomo's lieutenant governor, Kathy Chokol, I think is her name. I don't even know the name of our governor. She is pretty moderate reputation, but she has taken some very, very extreme actions, including the action of declaring racism to be a public health emergency. It got very little coverage, but when you declare something an emergency, usually under state law, it expands the powers of the governor to do something about it. And we're waiting to see what practical effect this will have. We also have a situation in New York where under new state regulations, there are racial preferences in the giving of medical care. Now, this, again, is something that should have been examined much more carefully before it was adopted. I don't even know if it's constitutional, but she has presided over that. At the same time, she still retains a lot of goodwill and retains the reputation as a more moderate Democrat than would normally be expected from the Democratic Party in New York.
Yeah. No, what's interesting to me about the mayor is that the Mayor Adams, that is that
yes,
he went along with this non-citizens voting. I was really surprised about that because I think that's going to get hit
yes.
in the courts. When it gets to the courts, I think that's going to lose. And then now I don't know if this is true or if this is a joke, so please confirm it. He named his brother to a high-ranking position and then said it's to protect him from white supremacists. Was that a joke that was going around or did that actually happen?
Well, he did name his brother as an assistant police commissioner or a deputy commissioner, a job for which he has absolutely no qualifications. It reminded everyone of President Kennedy naming his brother as Attorney General of the United States. Well, that was so controversial that it led to what's known as the Kennedy Law. You can't do that anymore. You can't appoint a close relative to certain positions. But he did it. It got very little reaction. Remember, this is New York. It's a liberal city. And it should have gotten a lot of bad reaction because it is nepotism. I mean, he gave his brother a job. And he also is now confronted by the fact that New York, or at least Manhattan, the borough of Manhattan, has a new DA who is one of the most leftist DAs in the United States. He is one of these Soros-supported DAs. It finally happened here. And he does not in any way intend to go along with Mayor Adams' tough-on-crime program. Now, Adams has not spoken about this new DA, but his police commissioner has, and in very blunt terms, of how much she disagrees with what this new DA stands for, which is to keep as many people out of prison as possible. It's too early to make judgments on Mayor Adams. He has said some good things. He has said some things that lead some observers to believe that he's just another guy who ran from the center and now will go to the left. It's going to take a little while before we know what he really has in mind.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think it's too early to judge the mayor, but it's not too early to say that what you're seeing there between the police commissioner and this DA is an internal war within the Democrat Party. Because I think you're really starting to see that, where a lot of a lot of Democrats are saying this is insanity. All this coddling of criminals is insanity, and we're going to get killed this November if we keep promoting this image. And I think the police commissioner can see that. The DA in Manhattan obviously cannot. And I think at some point you're going to see this battle go into many primaries in the Democrat Party in 2022, Bill.
Oh, the party is at war with itself, and it's a vicious war because I think the moderates in the party underestimated the ferocity of the far left. That we're not talking now just about people we used to call ultra-liberals. These are real leftists, and they brook no disagreement, and they will go after people. They will primary people, and the head of that gang is AOC. And she has threatened to primary people. And the fear, as I mentioned before, is that she herself this year will primary Chuck Schumer for the U.S. Senate seat from New York. Now, I don't think she will win if she tries it. But if she does, it will be a political earthquake of mammoth proportions because she will have brought down the Senate majority leader, depriving New York of all that seniority. But also, she will become a huge figure in American politics, much to the happiness of many journalists. They don't care if she's not qualified. She's big news. But if she brought down a giant like that, she becomes an extraordinarily powerful force in American politics, and in my view, a very negative force.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's move to another problem in the Democrat Party, another one of these internal wars. And that's the unions and some of the leadership in some of these cities and states. Chicago is the exhibit A, where the teachers unions are really hesitating to go back. The mayor of Chicago is threatening. And I keep waiting, Bill, maybe I'm unrealistic, but I keep waiting for a Democrat mayor or a Democrat governor to do a Reagan, what they call a Reagan, where he simply said, if you don't show up to work, I'm going to fire you. I don't know if a mayor or a governor has that authority, but somebody has to stand up to these unions. I mean, somebody on the Democrat side has to stand up to the unions. We don't have that problem in Texas, but they certainly have it in the blue states, Bill.
They do. Now, ironically, the mayor who has been toughest is the one you would least expect to be toughest, and that's Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, because the union there voted to stay out. They voted to stay home because they are afraid of COVID-19, and they feel it's all around them, and that they therefore must operate remotely. And the mayor basically said they are not running the city. I don't know if it's had any effect because Chicago is in such horrible shape as a city, but we could have the same situation here in New York where teachers could possibly decide to walk out claiming their health is being jeopardized. And I don't know what Mayor Adams would do. the teachers union is one of the most powerful elements in the Democratic Party. They supply huge amounts of money every year, and for the most part, the party collapses before them. The party just genuflects. A clash is building somewhere, but we don't know where it'll be because we don't know what state will be affected. It is possible that the teachers' unions will hold off and pull back a little bit in saying we're studying the matter because they may not feel this is an opportune time for them to become the villains.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting to me, Bill, is that there is a solution to this. I mean, if there's a teacher who has a health issue, you can make an exception to that teacher.
Sure.
Or if there's a student who has a health issue, you know, that student can stay home. I mean, there is a way to do this. And I think the teachers union ought to realize that if they keep acting the way they're acting, we're going to end up with school choice. And that's not going to be in the best interest of the union.
Well, that's true. The unions depend on the notion that they are made up of nice little ladies and little gentlemen who were really like the teachers that we were taught when we were in school and that our parents were taught by. It's not true. I mean, the profession of teaching today has, to a certain degree, been demeaned over the years. They are teaching strange things because they're graduates of teachers' colleges that have been taken over mostly by the hard left. And you find, for the first time in a long time that I can remember, real challenges to the authority of teachers, and it's coming mostly from parents who had a lot of talks with their children during the pandemic when the children were home and were not happy about what they heard was going on in school. So the profession of teaching itself is in some jeopardy from all sides, and I would be interested to see how they will react if other cities decide to bring their kids back to school rather than having them learn remotely. Remote learning has not worked. It really has not. And the kids are not being socialized. There is a real fear that real damage has been done to them psychologically and in terms of mental health in the last few years. So this, I think that education may emerge in 2022 as the most important issue in the country, if not one of the most important issues. It usually is not when you get the list of issues that are most talked about. It's usually kind of midway down the list. But in Virginia, clearly education was the major issue that brought the new governor to office. I think this, the parents' movement can grow because the left-wingers are not backing down. They're not making any compromises. They are defiant because they represent the heart of the political left, and the heart of the political left is always defiant. But I am looking forward to the next year to see what happens with education as an issue, and I think it's going to be fascinating.
Well, I think so. I think school choice is gaining. Homeschooling is gaining.
Yes.
And those are not good news for the teachers union because the parents are the ones who pay the taxes. I mean, so, if you're going to upset customer, you're in deep trouble. A couple of other topics I want to get into quickly before we run out of time, and that's Iran. You wrote about Iran. I also read something, Bill, that Iran is selling a lot of oil to China, and that might be a violation of their sanctions. So, the new administration is facing lots of challenges with respect to Iran, Bill.
It is, and this administration, being a liberal democratic administration, is not very tough on Iran. If you look at who is the negotiator for the Iran nuclear deal for Joe Biden, it's exactly the same person who was the negotiator for Barack Obama, which has led me to believe that we ought to consider the possibility that Barack Obama has an outsized influence on this administration. That's Robert Malley, who is a leftist and who doesn't seem to think Iran is that big a problem. There is some news today on the Iran negotiations in which we are not playing a direct role. We're playing an indirect role because we are still operating under the Trump withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. But there are some reports from the Iranian side that the West has made certain concessions and that the Iranian side feels things are back on track and heading toward a good agreement. Now, those words are used loosely. I'm not so sure the story is true, but it may be true. And if it is true and that they are heading toward an agreement, I think we have every right to be afraid of what that agreement will have.
Yeah. Another big story, Bill, and this may be happening today, and that is the Supreme Court may be deciding on mandates. I don't like to predict on the courts, but I think the courts are probably going to say that the president cannot issue a mandate like that on the private sector just by executive order, that if he wants to do it, he has to go through Congress. I think that's what they're going to say. That's my guess. But we saw something from Justice Sotomayor, and just absolutely amazing what she said during the debate. I'm going to give the lady justice the benefit of the doubt that this was simply a case of a law clerk handing her bad information. But what she said was so outrageous, Bill. Even the CDC director very politely had to admit in the interview that it's not 100,000. It's more like 3,000, which is a big difference, Bill, in the numbers when it comes to children.
Well, I don't know how well informed an individual Supreme Court justice is. You know, we make an assumption because they always want to appear scholarly and very, very erudite. But I don't know how erudite she really is. She was an Obama appointee. She was his first appointee to the Supreme Court. In part, it was an identity appointee. And I don't think that her role on the Supreme Court has been particularly outstanding. I haven't heard people just falling over backwards and saying, what a brilliant, brilliant justice. So I don't really know that much about her. But she did use some statistics at a time of national discussion about the pandemic, and those statistics were way off reality, and I think it has diminished her standing.
Well, yes. I mean, I think a lot of people just couldn't believe that she said something like that. Again, I don't know how well-informed these people are, but it seems to me if you're going to be passing judgment, judicial judgment, on mandates that, I don't know, I would have expected her to have a little bit better information. Again, this could be a law clerk who did this.
Yes.
It could be a law clerk who just passed this bad information to her, but nevertheless, it did not make her look good. One last question I wanted to ask you, Bill, and that has to do with the CDC. The director was on television yesterday, and I cut these people a lot of slack because it is a difficult topic, and it's not something that is black and white, and it's evolving. So, you know, I cut them a lot of slack. I don't expect them to be perfect in everything they say, Bill, but it looks to me like they have a communication problem, the CDC, that is, Bill.
They have a serious communication problem, as does the entire federal government. The handling of news about this virus has been terrible. Now, at one time, when President Trump was in office, he would hold press conferences with these experts, and they would answer questions, and that was pretty good, but for some reason, there are a lot of medical people around the U.S. government who just can't keep their mouth shut, and they come out with these statements. They often contradict statements made by other medical doctors or medical researchers, and so the American people cannot get a clear picture of what is happening and a clear picture of what is expected of them. Now, one fix for this is a press that actually does real reporting. I mean, if the press would simply say, today this is what is happening, today this is the latest advice from the U.S. government, and today this is how people are following that advice. The press itself has been lazy. I think that's the kindest word I can use, lazy in the reporting of the news. We were told by Anderson Cooper, that great doctor of medicine, to follow the science. But what he has never told us, and what other journalists have never told us, is what science would you like us to follow? They gave us this impression of science as this kind of godlike career, this godlike establishment that must be taken seriously and that all their commandments must be followed. But the fact is that science is medicine is an art as well as a science. And doctors disagree, medical researchers disagree. And the disagreements are making it impossible to follow the actual course that we are expected as citizens to follow. And I think people have lost a great deal of faith in the medical profession as a result of this information disaster.
I agree. And it's becoming very difficult to take these people seriously. Again, I think this lady is doing the best that she can. But here's I'll say this last thing, Bill. I think what happened in 2020 is that President Trump actually did a pretty good job in handling what was at the time a brand new problem, one in a century type problem. But the Democrats and the media basically just had a narrative that Trump didn't know what he was doing and that he was stupid, that he wasn't following the science. That was the narrative. And then the solution to that problem was to bring the Democrats in because the Democrats were going to be the ones who were going to fix all of this. Well, it turns out that the virus is a little bit more complicated than that. And I think we're dealing right now with the consequences of having politicized the virus back in 2020. And, you know, the Democrats are having a lot of frustrations with the virus because it's turning out to be a lot more complicated than simply blaming it on Trump, who I think in retrospect did a pretty good job, Bill.
I think he did too. Operation Warp Speed was his idea, and that developed caused the vaccines, and the vaccines were developed in record time. I give Trump a great deal of credit. Biden has really not done anything particularly effective during the time he's been in office. He seems very confused about the facts, and I don't get a sense of where the federal government wants us to go. The press conferences are kind of dueling press conferences, and some of the television stations, at least the ones I listen to, have done a great service in presenting dissenting views, and these dissenting views are often held by people from very distinguished institutions. These are not views being held by crackpots. We have a real debate within the scientific community about certain aspects of the virus and how it should be treated, and I think that in turn has led to a kind of unhappiness, a wariness, a suspicion, not a healthy situation.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think people are tired of the virus. I'm tired of it. I'm sure everybody else is too. But I wish I could just rely on the people who are supposed to be giving us information. And unfortunately, they've become even more controversial than the politicians themselves. And that's not
absolutely
a good thing.
Absolutely correct.
I mean, if I could give President Biden advice, I would say, you know, just have a chat with Dr. Fauci and tell him that it may be time for him to go home and put somebody fresh in there who at least can start from square one. Well, Bill, as always, thank you for your time and thank you very much for joining us and the great work at Urgent Agenda that you do. And we look forward to next week. I'm sure that I have a funny feeling that we'll be talking a lot about these things next week, Bill.
I think we will, and there could be some real news on the Iran negotiation, and if it comes through or if an agreement comes through, that will be a major issue immediately. I also think we are not finished, as you just pointed out, with discussion about the schools. I mean, the schools are going back after Christmas vacation. That's always a wobbly time. And let's see if we have a rash of school closings. And
that could
throw the whole country off.
Well, that would make a lot of parents very angry. I can tell you that right now. I think if all of a sudden you have all these school closings, I think parents are going to explode because, they need to have those kids back in school. Have a great, I didn't even ask you about the weather in New York, but you're not getting any bad weather, I take it, right?
We had just a little bit of snow up here over the weekend, but nothing disastrous.
Oh, okay. Good. All right. Have a great day, Bill, and we'll chat next week.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it, Silvio.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, wrapping up another week in review. Lots of issues in the country, and I am expecting something on the mandate probably in the next 24 hours. Have a great day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.